We are here for week three of Jews and Clothes, and I'm just going to mute everybody by default because I'm getting background noise. The topic for today is the Jewish badge. I actually gave a class on a related point dealing with the Jewish badge at Arath Israel 5 years ago. So if this sounds at all familiar, you may remember it from there. Some of you may have been there. But in any case, for anyone who is not yet registered and getting the emails for the class, make sure, please, that you do that. I'll put the link in the chat for people who need to sign up still. Just take a second. There you go. Okay, but let's get moving. We've talked about Jews and clothing. We've talked about Jewish clothing. We've talked about Jewish prayer clothing. And what I want to do today is to talk about clothing that was forced upon the Jews and was, interestingly, I find it interesting, something of a perversion of a Jewish idea. And that is what we call the class, the Jewish badge. Take a look, please, at the first source on the sheet. This is the text, as you see, titled there, of Canon 68, issued by the Fourth Lateran Council, the year 1215, under Pope Innocent III. Yes, I love it when they name their Pope Innocent. By 1215, they'd already done it three times. Go figure. So, take a look at source number one. In some provinces, a difference in dress distinguishes the Jews or Saracens from the Christians, Saracens being Muslims. But in certain others, such a confusion has grown up that they cannot be distinguished by any difference. Thus, it happens at times that through error, Christians have relations with the women of Jews or Saracens, and Jews and Saracens with Christian women. It's very interesting. I just noticed now the fact that it's, well, never mind. I'll come back to that maybe later. Therefore, that they may not, under pretext of error of this sort, excuse themselves in the future for the excesses of such prohibited intercourse, we decree that such Jews and Saracens of both sexes in every Christian province and at all times shall be marked off in the eyes of the public from other peoples through the character of their dress. Particularly since it may be read in the writings of Moses that this very law has been enjoined upon them. Right? What law is this referring to? From Numbers 15? What law are they referring to that enjoins that they be marked off from others?
Tzitzit.
Correct. It's the law of tzitzis. Having fringes on the corner of a four, on the corners of a four-cornered garment, precisely. So they say, we need to make sure that we avoid inappropriate relations between Christians and Jews and Muslims. And after all, if you look in the Torah, you find the law of tzitzit marking Jews as apart. So let's have Jews and Muslims wear special garb. Moreover, during the last 3 days before Easter, and especially on Good Friday, they shall not go forth in public at all, for the reason that some of them on these very days, as we hear, do not blush to go forth better dressed, and are not afraid to mock the Christians who maintain the memory of the most holy passion by wearing signs of mourning. They don't like Jews wearing clothing that is not mourning clothing on the 3 days before Easter. Okay, how do you feel about their invocation of tzitzit into this? The fact that they pick up on this Jewish practice and throw that in as part of the justification for the badge. What's your reaction?
I have to say that we are so, we live in such a bubble, living in Canada and North America, that we're so accustomed to separation of church and state and of our rights, and the fact that there is not a government-ordained church, certainly not in the U.S., although here, I mean, you could argue that the Catholic Church is the church of state in Canada. We have to support the Catholic schools, and we have to give the Catholic school system part of our taxes when we sell our house. So,
We're going to come back to that.
So why are we surprised that we should dress the same as Goyim? And also, I don't understand the whole business of the Hasidic garb.
Okay, so I'm going to...
of looking different and always being recognizable.
Right. So the issue of the Hasidic garb is something we're going to come back to hopefully later in the series. I want to go back a little bit towards where you began it. The church is different from the state in this, and we'll see that when it comes to enforcement. This is a church-issued practice. The church at this stage in history did not have the enforcement arms that they would develop in the Inquisition a little bit later on that would ultimately enforce the Jewish badge as well. The Dominican order, the Franciscan order, I don't think they were around at this point in 1215. But I'm asking how you feel about their invocation of tzitzit for this, and that goes back a little bit in terms of what Dalia was noting, that Jews have a practice of dressing apart. That is something that has been part of our identity. We do have the Midrash about the Jews in Egypt dressing differently from the non-Jews among them. Although there are certain biblical texts that call that into question, right? Like when they're going to leave and they specifically get clothing from their non-Jewish neighbors. So if you're dressing differently, why are you getting clothing from your non-Jewish neighbors? What's that about? There's more to be said regarding this. But let me take others on this. How do you feel about the church invoking tzitzit as a basis for having Jews wear a badge to identify them as different?
It's like mixing apples and oranges. One thing has nothing to do with the other.
Why?
Tzitzit is it's not like it's done to separate us from others. It's done for our own recognition of what we're supposed to do and what we're not supposed to do.
So that's an interesting question. What is the motivation for tzitzit? And we're going to come back to that. You're suggesting that tzitzit has a motivation that's not about separating us. Rosalind, you're muted.
So perhaps what they're saying is that we've already separated ourselves with our clothing. So the badge is just one more identification factor.
Mm-hmm. So you look apart anyway.
But that's only for men. I mean, women, I guess, well, women don't have much agency anyway at this point.
Well, no, they're specifically about that. You're right. Because they say in the beginning that they're concerned about relations between Jewish women and Christians and vice versa. I should note also, by the way, they're throwing in the Muslims. The Muslims don't, as far as I know, they don't have a tzitzit practice. They do have many things that they've taken from Torah, but I don't believe that tzitzit is one of them. So there are a lot of ways you could look at this. I think you could look at this as an act of violence against Judaism. You're using Judaism against itself. Yeah, I think that's something. It's a little bit of an act of mockery of Judaism. Like, hey, you have your own garb, and now we're going to invoke that in order to require you to wear this garb. It's interesting to me, because I think that it does reflect something that is true about Judaism, but it warps it. And that's where I want to go. I want to first talk about the history of the badge itself and then come around to the philosophy involved, where it is an accurate reflection of Judaism and where it very much is not. You follow? Okay. So, first of all, people are often unaware of this. The badge, the Jewish garb, does not begin in Christianity. It actually begins in Islam. Starts with them. The Pact of Umar, in the 7th century, and I gave you the relevant part in source number 2. We shall show respect toward the Muslims. I'm sorry, let me give the background. I realize I didn't give enough background here. This is the excerpt here is what is expected of a Jew who wishes to live, or a Christian for that matter, any non-Muslim, who wishes to live within Muslim society. That's the beginning of this. And so the speaker in this paragraph is the non-Muslim. So in order to live under Caliph Omar, we shall show respect toward the Muslims. We shall rise from our seats when they wish to sit. We shall not seek to resemble the Muslims by imitating any of their garments, the kalansua, which is a turban, footwear, the parting of the hair, apparently there was a special hairstyle. We shall not speak as they do, nor shall we adopt their kunyas, which are nicknames and honorifics. We shall always dress in the same way wherever we may be, meaning we will have a special garment that identifies all of us, and we shall bind the zunar around our waists. The zunar is a broad yellow belt, according to Salo Baron in the Jewish community and also the Jewish Encyclopedia and in the article on the badge. Interesting note regarding the use of yellow. There are various writings in Islam which speak to the significance of certain colors. And I found some material regarding yellow. And I brought you a sample of it in source number 3. I don't know how authoritative this is within Islam. It's important to recognize that in a way that should be familiar for Jews. In Islam, you find various writings, some of which are considered more authoritative, some of which are considered less authoritative, some of which contradict each other. So it's never quite clear. But take a look at this. Red, yellow, and saffron are primitive colors. Rolling back thousands of years into history and as still evidenced today, this is a contemporary article, this is from our time, these three colors of red, yellow, and saffron have always been associated with primitive communities. These primitive communities have used mainly red and yellow colors to paint their places of worship. I have to say I'm not familiar with any synagogues that use red and yellow as a color scheme, nonetheless. These places of worship are generally temples of various descriptions, which contain several idols and which are worshipped instead of Allah. The painting of temples in red and yellow also brings about their distinctive identification of what they are and their purpose, hence it becomes fundamental expectation that Muslims' places where Allah is remembered and revered very much must never be painted in red or yellow or combinations of red and yellow. So, yeah, red and yellow apparently is a non-Muslim color scheme. And they want us to wear the zunar, this belt that is yellow, as appropriate for our primitive society. Yes, Dahlia.
I'm sorry. Just when you said yellow, I couldn't help but remember the Jewish yellow star.
Oh, we're getting there. Yeah. No, we are going to include that in the conversation. Absolutely. So. Here in the Muslim part of it, other than this zunar, this belt, there isn't much of a specification of a particular article of clothing. This is the mandatory article of clothing that you have to wear. In the year 807, though, there's a Muslim caliph. This is from the Abbasid dynasty. His name was Harun al-Rashid, and he ordered Jews to wear the zunar, the yellow belt, as well as a tall cone-like hat. Okay, a tall cone-like hat. And that becomes a staple in pictures of Jews in the Middle Ages. I'm sorry, I'm just going to go through a little bit here. There was a Sicilian ruler, Ibrahim, who introduced badges specifically for Jews and Christians. And this is the year 887. Christians had to display a badge in the shape of swine. Jews, a badge in the shape of a monkey. This is not so surprising. This is a passage, I believe, in the Quran, talking about non-Muslims as pigs and monkeys. So this was, you know, we didn't get to be the pig, presumably because pigs are so anathema in Judaism, even though monkeys aren't kosher either, I should point out. But presumably that's where this comes in. And then in the year 1005, and then I'll pause for a minute, the Jews of Egypt were ordered to wear bells on their garments. which is interesting and reminiscent of the high priest in the Mishkan. They had to wear bells and a wooden calf in order to remind us of the golden calf. So the Jews must be reminded of their sins. Fascinating stuff. This is all in Muslim society, not in Christian society. So pausing for comment now, and then we're going to go on to the Catholics. Yes, Rose.
I think in Rome, in Italy, Rome, they had to wear the pointed hats as well.
Right. So we're getting to the Christians.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. We're going to get to the Christians next. I just thought it was fascinating because I grew up thinking that there was the Christian badge. I never realized that it was actually a Muslim thing first. Yes, Eti.
But the Christian society was before the Muslim society.
So it is true that Christianity is around for centuries before Islam, but it appears that when the Roman Empire went Christian, they did not issue edicts regarding dressing apart. We do find anti-Jewish statements from their councils, but we don't find the dress required of them. It's with the Muslim conquest that this becomes a rule for non-Muslims, and then the church borrows it from them. The church had a lot of practice borrowing things from Judaism, so it's not so surprising they would adopt from them as well. Rose, you were going to say?
One last thing is, in the Middle East, we were regarded as the Dhimmis.
Right, the Dhimmi comes from that Pact of Omar. That's the term for our status.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So this is all within Muslim society. Christianity, it appears, in the lands that they control at that time, have not adopted that. However, the concept behind it, the idea that we're going to compel non-Muslims to wear special garb, that they should be marked as being apart, is something that really fits the medieval Catholic approach to Jews. Not only in terms of keeping us apart, but in terms of despising the Jews, in terms of degrading the population. Yeah, they contended that we killed their God, whatever that means, and therefore we deserve subjugation, and therefore we deserve degradation. And they issued legislation that was generally aimed at converting Jews and preventing Jews from influencing Christians. So that will lead to the badge. It will lead to the ghetto. It will lead to the conversional sermon in which they forced Jews to go to church on Sundays and to hear a sermon aimed at forcing the Jews or convincing the Jews to convert. The popes during the period of the Crusades, generally speaking, would protect individual Jews from massacre, communities from massacre. However, they designed all sorts of laws to promote Christianity and to get Jews to convert to Christianity. When you think of the disputations, right, the forced debates, like what Nachmanides had to engage in, we learned about that in a class a couple of years ago. That's also a function of this. And it's particularly now, at this point in Christian history, when you get to the 13th century, that the church is becoming bolder. Number one, emboldened by the Crusades, the militancy of the Crusades. And number two, because they've been fighting heresies within and succeeding. So there's a heresy that they combat in southern France in this period. And if you're going to combat Christian heresies within the Christian community, well, you're also going to combat these heresies within the Jewish community. The Jews are, after all, heretics of heretics. We don't accept Christianity at all. And that brings us to Pope Innocent III. Innocent III was the pope from 1198 until 1216. And here I'm drawing a lot from the work A History of the Jewish People by Marx and Margolis. In general, there are some very, very good reference books for those who want to know more about the history of this time. Some of them you'll see quoted on the page. Cecil Roth, as a historian, is excellent. I used his History of the Jews of Italy, the Jews in the Renaissance. Israel Abrams, I believe I quoted here, Jewish Life in the Middle Ages. There are some very, very good books for those who want to know more about this. So Innocent III is zealous in promoting unity of faith, getting rid of what he perceives as heresies. He's a man of action. And he says Jews are to blame for not believing. However, Jews should not be killed because they have to be living witnesses to the truth of Christianity. Meaning, when people see the way that the Jews are degraded, it just demonstrates to them Christianity is right. The same Pope Innocent, in the year 1199, he renewed Alexander III's privileges of Jews. Like, he wanted Jews to be able to live there. He just wanted us to be degraded as a way to show people the church won. That doesn't mean, you know, when I say he lets us live there, like, he is not a friend by any stretch of the imagination. In that Fourth Lateran Council in the year 1215, where they issued Canon 68 that we read before, he also ordered Jews to release crusaders from interest payments on debts. If a Christian went on the crusade, they could have the interest forgiven on their debt. And in the event that a Jew failed to comply, then they would be banned from dealings with Christians. And he had all sorts of other rulings as well. Dahlia, I see your note in the chat. I might ask about it a little bit. I want to go through the introduction of the badge in Christianity. So the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215 is what brings the badge into Christianity. Now, the Jews of Aragon in northern Spain, headed by Isaac Benvenisti, who was the physician to King James I, they allied themselves with the Jews of Provence, and they sent a delegation to Rome to try to prevent anti-Jewish measures. So this is not new, in other words. The idea of Jews trying to send a delegation and try to avoid things, this happened, we know, with the expulsion from Spain. It's happened at various times, and unfortunately often is not successful. And in this case also, they were not successful. So the goal of the badge is, as we've already said, to prevent sexual intercourse between Christians and Jews, lest anybody be confused. It's to fulfill their philosophy that Jews have to suffer persecution because they rejected Christianity. And it's meant to encourage Jews to convert to Christianity. Those are the major reasons why they introduce it. However, there is one other element, unsurprising. Take a look at source number 4. Israel Abrams in Jewish Life in the Middle Ages points out, Philippe le Bel, also known as King Philip IV of France, devised the sale of badges as a fresh source of income for the royal exchequer. In other words, not only do you have to wear the badge, you have to buy the badge off of the authorities. Not only did you have to wear it, you had to buy it. That was so it also was a source of income, which is really smart when you think about it. Not only is it smart, obviously they're making money, but it's smart for another reason. We're going to see shortly that there was the local governments were not always in favor of imposing these rules against the Jews. Sometimes it was difficult to get the local governments to enforce things. Maybe though, having the Jews pay into it would give an incentive to the local government. This is a revenue thing for you, and therefore you should do it. Okay, Dahlia, I saw your note in the chat from your husband that Jews in Iran. You wrote the Jewish women would never wear garments that were religious symbols of devout Muslim women. I think that's consistent with what we've said so far. That
but also there were other things. Yeah. For example, the chadors, they always had to be covered up with women. And women were not allowed to walk around in public without a man, period, in Muslim society. So there was no possible chance that a Muslim man could even meet a Jewish woman because she would not walk around, not accompanied by a member of her family, even if she went to a market.
Right.
So that was one way of guarding against, you know, possible intercourse between Jewish woman.
Right.
Okay. Like also, she would never wear the clothing of a devout Muslim woman.
Right, and that's consistent with the Pact of Omar.
In various towns, they had to wear various hats. They weren't always conical, but they were the Jewish hat. And it was very important for Jews to distinguish themselves from Muslims as far as Muslim society was concerned, because a Jew could not walk on the same street if a Muslim was walking on it. You couldn't walk on a sidewalk if there was a Muslim. You had to step into the gutter.
Dahlia? How, Dahlia, just how recent were these? Like, this, what?
Until the 20th century.
Really?
Until the Shah's father.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's very interesting to know.
And so if anybody can think anything they want about how great it was in these Muslim countries, and the Jews talk about the Shah's father and the Shah like they were wonderful because he protected the Jews. Hello. And then the other thing was is that Jews were not allowed to walk in the street when it was raining, because if the rain bounced off them, and they weren't allowed to touch food that Muslims would eat because they would make it coming.
Right. So that's a whole other thing, which, Dahlia, sorry, there's way too much to do. Sorry. I'm going to have to, we could do a special session on the Jews of Iran, and I think it will be fascinating.
But I just want you to understand that this clothing thing is only one.
Yes, that is correct. That is definitely correct. There was a note in the chat from Leah about the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto having to pay for their guards at the gates. This is something, the issue of paying for the persecution, is something that we saw in a class several years ago. We had a session on censorship of Jewish books. We had a series on clashes in Jewish publishing, and we talked about the church censoring Jewish books. And we pointed out that there were periods in which Jews actually had to pay the censor who was going to put glue or burn or whatever the Jewish books. So yes, this was it became a moneymaker. Okay, progress of the badge. So because enforcement was local and because the church didn't yet have the Franciscans and the Dominicans, the result was that enforcement really varied. The size, the shape, the color, the nature of the badge was all left to the local government. There were cases, rare ones, but there were cases in which the Jewish community was actually allowed to design their own badge, which is interesting. But the local government, as we said, would enforce it. And the way the local governments enforced it when they wanted to do so was by fining people who wouldn't wear it, and also by issuing rewards for Jews who would be informants. The penalties were usually financial, but sometimes it went beyond that. I think I brought you on the sheet. Yeah, take a look at source number 5 from Cecil Roth, talking about Emperor Frederick II of, I'm going to mispronounce this, I think it's Hohenstaufen or something along those lines. I'm just going to mute everybody because I'm getting background noise again. So take a look at number 5. This was the case above all. He's talking about local enforcement and non-enforcement and reasons for local government to enforce it. So this was the case above all with the Emperor Frederick II of Hohenstaufen. He was the Holy Roman Emperor, you see, in 1220 to 1250. He was the King of Sicily with Apulia, 1197 to 1250. He was, as has been seen, a man of exceptional culture and breadth of outlook, so much so as to draw suspicion upon him in that generally unenlightened age. He found it absolutely necessary, therefore, to vindicate his orthodoxy in matters which were to him of minor importance, and the Jews were the victims. In other words, he had to prove his loyalty to the church. So the way he did it was by enforcing their rules against the Jews. Right? That would demonstrate I am a good Christian, because I'm carrying out what the church wants me to carry out against the Jews. This came up also, I didn't bring you any sources on it, in the time of James of Aragon, in the latter half of the 13th century in northern Spain, where the church threatened to excommunicate him if he wouldn't carry out certain decrees against the Jews. So you end up with local governments sometimes enforcing it because they need it to burnish their credentials with the church. There were Jews who were exempt from the badge at certain times in certain places. So Cecil Roth notes in source number 6 that Jewish physicians were exempt in certain places during the 16th century and later on as well. He says, Samuel Sarfati was a doctor. The Pope, on appointing him to his service, later empowered him to attend on Christian patients without formality and freed him from the obligation of wearing the Jewish badge. Musicians, particular musicians, were exempted. Salomon de Rossi in Italy in the 17th century was exempt from the badge. In 16th century Vienna, Jewish merchants who worked for the court of Vienna paid a special tax, and they got certain privileges, including exemption from the Jewish badge. History of the Jews in Vienna records that. The styles of the badge really diversified. Often they were round, although not always. Can you suggest why it would be round? Why would the church make it round? Nothing? So, I've seen three suggestions, each one very interesting. One suggestion is that it was meant to represent a coin, because Jews and money. Also, Judas taking money, that whole, you know, piece within Christianity. Second, the shape of a communion wafer. Who knew they were round? I thought they used square matzos. I don't know. But the shape of a communion wafer. Third, out of three, is that it was meant to represent a full moon as opposed to the crescent of Islam. So the symbol in Islam would be the crescent, and the Jews would be the full moon, which is interesting. Generally, it was made of cloth, but not always. There were cases of leather, there were cases of silk, and the styles really varied. We talked already about a golden calf earlier. In England, at some point in the late 13th century, Jews had to wear two tablets. That was your badge, was the two tablets. In 1222, the emperor orders Jews in Italy to wear a bluish badge. It wouldn't be Italy. It wasn't Italy yet. There's provinces, but some in Italian provinces, I suppose, to wear a bluish badge, I think to represent tcheles, right? The blue dye that we associate with tzitzit. It was supposed to be in the shape of the Greek letter tau. I don't know why. In 1257, the Papal States required women to wear two blue stripes on their head coverings. I imagine that's also tchelet. Are people having trouble with my internet, or you're okay? There's a message in the chat with someone having trouble, but no, everyone's good? Okay. In the year 1360, Rome orders male Jews to wear short red coats and women to wear red petticoats. Unless you're a doctor. If you're a doctor, you're exempt. And then in 1394, in Venice, Jews are supposed to wear a yellow O, which 100 years later becomes a yellow hat. The colors vary. Yellow was a common color in England, in Germany for these things. In Switzerland, in 1435, it's red cloth. France, it was generally yellow. I guess yellow was just the in color. And you have these hats. I gave you a picture in number 7 for the Judenhut. This is Austria, 13th century. Also Germany, 14th and 15th centuries. Had to be pointed at the top. It was usually red, and the brim was sometimes twisted into horns. In 18th century Austria, it was green. I feel like someone somewhere has to have done a doctorate on the colors of these badges explaining the choice, you know, beyond what we talked about with the Muslim view about the primitive colors. But a very wide variety over time. So how would you think this badge or hat or whatever, tablets, whatever this was in different times and places, what do you think the impact was on the Jews? What would the impact have been, just logically?
That we would feel inferior and we feel downtrodden.
Right. Well, let's start even before we get to the emotional piece of it. it creates vulnerability, right? Jews identified in this way are easier to kill or to torture because we can find them. In the year 1221, in the city of Erfurt, about 96 Jews were killed. They were identified based on wearing this special garb. Also, from a psychological perspective, it becomes easier for Christian communities to justify ghettoization because the Jews are now a different population and looked down on. Interestingly, it also affects Jewish law. There is a rule that we are not supposed to carry things on Shabbat outside of our homes, right? You don't carry things in a public domain. Are you allowed to wear this badge? It's not really part of your clothing. It's something that you are attaching to your clothing because the government says so. But if you're going to go out without it, you could end up in very serious danger. So take a look at source number 8. Rabbi Moshe Isserles. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the recorder of Ashkenazi comments in the Code of Jewish Law, living, as you see there, 16th century Poland, would have been very familiar with this. He writes, connecting an item to clothing is effective, meaning the item you attach becomes like part of your clothes, only if that item is ordinarily connected to clothing in that place. So in other words, you're going to walk around on Shabbos, forget the badge discussion, with a brooch, right, attached to your clothing, that's fine, because people normally have that. That is clothing in and of itself. You're not carrying the brooch, you're wearing the brooch. As opposed to, you have a key to get into your house, and you say, well, I'm going to just pin the key to my clothing. That doesn't work, because no one attaches keys to their clothing, unless it's artistic and it's actually made into some, you know, jewelry. It's now a tie clip or whatever it is. So Rabbi Isserles says, if the item is normally connected to clothing in that place, that's fine. Something that is not ordinarily connected in that way is forbidden. And then he says, one may travel with the green stars, which the government of Persia has decreed all Jews must bear on their garments, even if the stars are weakly linked and not sewn. And the reason why he mentions the weakly linked is because we have concerns when something is not attached well, that it's going to fall and you're going to carry it. But he says, even if it's just weakly linked to the garment, it's fine, you can go out with it. But you notice who he says ordered these green stars. The government of Persia. I can't say with certainty, but I'm fairly sure that the rabbi of Krakow in the 16th century never went to Persia and had no idea what it was like to be in Persia. I mean, he probably had an idea because there was correspondence. It's not fair to say he had no idea. But he's writing Persia because he's publishing this in Poland. And he can't say the Polish government. He can't say the king of Poland. So he's going to say the king of Persia. Much the same way as Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein in his Aruch HaShulchan, the rabbi of Novarduk at the beginning of the 20th century, end of the 19th century, when he wants to talk about problematic governments, he says the government of Egypt. Again, he never went to Egypt. But it's a lot safer to say that than to say the czar. So, as a matter of fact, Rabbi Epstein is actually up next. I forgot I had him next. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, writing in his Aruch HaShulchan, talks about this issue of green stars and the like. He says the case of the green stars is more lenient than the case of bell decorations, requiring only a small attachment, not weaving or stitching. For the government obligates people to wear the stars on their garments. People are afraid to travel without the stars, and they guard the stars from falling off. In other words, he says, if you're going to wear some kind of ornament on your clothing that the government did not mandate, then it has to be attached really well. Because otherwise, we're worried it falls off and you carry it. However, when it comes to what the government ordered, we're not concerned because you're going to make sure that it doesn't fall off your garment. We know that people are careful because they don't want to get into trouble. So that's why it's acceptable. My point in bringing this is just to show that the badge is not only a cultural phenomenon, it enters into Jewish law. it affects the lives of Jews who are obedient of Jewish law. There's a sense that it creates for Jews, though, going back to the emotional impact. There's a sense of being outcasts and being alien. I brought you from Jewish life in the Middle Ages in source number 10, fascinating observation from Israel Abrams. He says, the effects produced by this system of branding the Jews as a pariah class were as deplorable as they were inevitable. The Jew became the mark for the meanest of insults. Quote, beaten, reviled, scorned, and abused by everyone, he was made to swallow abuse like water. He was not allowed to take offense at anything. He's quoting that from Israel Among the Nations. He lost his old refinements. Of old, no people had paid more attention to accuracy and polish in speech, to decency and cleanliness in dress, to self-respect in their manners and bearing. This is a little bit of a polemic, frankly, and I'm not 100% sure that I'm confident in it, but he says that Jews previously had developed expertise in local language and manners, and that now they neglected it because they were downtrodden within society. But I think there are some other impacts. I think that the explosion of Jewish text in this period, in part, is meant to make Jews feel stronger. The Khuzari, I'm now going way back to the 11th century, living under Muslims, he names his book In Defense of the Despised Faith. And that was something that Jews, you know, looked to. That's a work of philosophy. They're trying to defend themselves and to strengthen themselves. And so you publish texts about Judaism that are meant to encourage and inspire Jews to stick with it. Another element, this was very interesting to me. I grew up with this kind of dichotomy in my head from the books I read regarding Jews' approaches to government, where on the one hand, I grew up in the U.S., you know, 1970s, 80s, 90s, and, you know, loyal to the government, you know, would never do anything that was illegal and so on. And at the same time, I was reading books about Jews in Russia and Poland and places like that bribing the government because of various things, and I just took it as normal. Like, I didn't realize that I'm living kind of two different existences in that regard. But when the government is forcing you to wear a badge, when the government is degrading you and persecuting you, the result is a sense that secular authority is something to be thwarted, right? Something to be avoided, something to be overcome. And obviously the Holocaust reinforces that more than anything else. The result being that to this day, we have Jewish communities which are very hostile to government authority. I mean, we saw it during the pandemic. A lot of it comes from this sense that government is here to hurt us. And if they're making us do something, it can't be good. And I'm not going into all the different applications of that and not having that conversation. My point is only to say that this is where a lot of that is born. So the end of all of this, and when I say end, I don't mean termination, but the result of all of this is what was mentioned briefly earlier, the yellow badge, the yellow star, under the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. And I found a great article, which I gave you in source number 11, I gave you a link, History of the Yellow Star Inscribed with Jude. It's very interesting to note, and a lot of this comes from that piece. When the Nazis declared a boycott on Jewish stores in April 1st, 1933, so individual non-Jews painted yellow stars of David on the windows of Jewish stores. This is long before there is a badge. The Nazis had not even discussed badges at this point. You're talking here April 1933. There was a German Zionist leader named Robert Welch who actually wrote an article at the time, which the title translated into English was Wear the Yellow Badge with Pride. Like, if they're going to make us, they're going to put yellow stars on our businesses, then we're going to wear the badge with pride. The first time that the Nazis start to discuss the having a Jewish badge was in a meeting on November 12th, 1938. So you're basically talking about 85 years ago, you know, 85 years ago last week, when right after Kristallnacht, it's only a couple of days after Kristallnacht, they're talking about having Jews wear a badge, and they start to implement it in September 1939 in Poland. So for example, in November 16th, 1939, so that's tomorrow, they order a Jewish badge in the city of Lodz. So it's that period when they actually start to carry it out, and without a doubt, it's informed by what had been going on for centuries and centuries in Christian Europe, and before that, in Muslim lands. They weren't inventing something new as much as borrowing it. Dahlia.
Just a quick topic. Nazism, was it part of Christianity?
So it was heavily influenced by Christianity. Heavily influenced.
I never thought of it Christian.
Yes, no, there's a lot to be said about
Christian.
That. Right. So no, there's a heavy Christian influence. There's a lot to say about that. But yes, not to mention just the very fact of the ground being laid by all that anti-Semitism through the centuries, made all of that possible. So I want to shift gears to go back to the Fourth Lateran Council and their use of tzitzis. Invoking that and what they're really doing with it, which is kind of a perversion of it. Tzitzit are a very important mitzvah in Judaism. In source number 12, I gave you the verses from the Torah, from the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, where God says to Moses, speak to the children of Israel, bid them that they make them fringes in the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of each corner a thread of tchelet. Tchelet is wool dyed with something color that is roughly bluish purple. There's some debate about the precise color. It is believed in Israel today that they have discovered the snail that was used for this, the Murex trunculus. There's a lot of debate and discussion about this that we're not going to go into now. But that's supposed to be on the corner of the garment, and many Jews today, in fact, use that dye. It shall be to you as a fringe that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of God and do them, and that you seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you go astray, that you may remember and do all my commandments and be holy to your God. That's the Koran translation, which I just, borrowed because it was cut and pasteable online. So this is, what they are referring to when they borrow that. Rabbis historically have explained tzitzit in line with the text, which said, look upon it and remember all the commandments of God. In other words, and I think someone was trying to say this in the very beginning, we don't look at tzitzit as being about looking different from others. We look at it in terms of reminding us of God. If you take a look at source number 13 from the Talmud, Rabbi Meir used to say, why is tchelet different from any other color? Why is that the color that we're supposed to use for the string? Because tchelet resembles the sea resembles the heavens resemble the divine throne, as it is written, the verse from Exodus, and beneath his feet was a kind of paved work of sapphire stone and like the very heaven for clarity. That's talking about God at Sinai. It's meant to remind us of God. Why you need all these layers, which resembles the sea, which resembles the heavens, is a great discussion, but not for the moment. It's supposed to remind us of God, and it's supposed to surround us with mitzvot. And because it surrounds us with mitzvot, therefore it reminds us of commandedness, of being commanded. If you take a look at source number 14, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, thus when the sensitive eye and the sensitive heart of man wander out into the visible world and are then thrown back upon themselves, they look at themselves, they find the human garment, the first visible characteristic distinguishing man from beast, reminding man of his superiority over brutishness and making him aware of the existence of the invisible one and his word, and recalling vividly God, human dignity, and the mission of Israel. In other words, it isn't just about remembering particular commandments. It's about remembering that we are elevated above the animal. We have a relationship with God. Some of you may remember a line I've quoted frequently from Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, that in the Torah, when God talks to Adam in the Garden of Eden, and it says, Vayitzav, he commanded man. So Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote, he takes man into his confidence. God says to the human being, we have a relationship by doing that. That's what we are remembering with tzitzit. Now, I know for sure that among those here, someone is wondering, so why is it that traditionally men wore it as opposed to women wearing it? Wouldn't it be a neat idea for everybody to be able to wear it? So I'm not getting into the full discussion of it right now, only to say that the as you can read the text in number 12, it doesn't distinguish. It doesn't distinguish in this text between men and women. There are certain things that develop that lead to the practice of men wearing it as opposed to women wearing it. And again, it's not really the topic right now. We should do a series sometimes on things like this. I'm just noting for you that the concepts that are involved here, remembering commandedness, remembering God, and so on, are meant to be for everybody. Having said that, yeah, this is not really a mitzvah about standing apart from everybody else. That's not really why we do it. We do it to remember all these positive things. Nonetheless, the issue of being marked as different is consistent with Jewish policy on dress in general. As a general principle, we do stand apart from others in the way that we dress. I'm going to skip source number 15 because I don't think it's as relevant as I thought when I put it on the sheet. And I'm going to jump instead to source number 16. Number 16 is a verse in Leviticus in which we are told, do not perform acts like those of the land of Egypt where you lived. Do not perform acts like those of the land of Canaan to which I am bringing you. And do not walk in their ways. And that's the key phrase. Do not walk in their ways. What does that mean? Don't walk in the ways of the nations. So take a look at source number 17. The Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch. Mechaber is Rabbi Yosef Karo. You may remember we had a class in which we learned about him a couple of years ago. So he is the author of the Code of Jewish Law. And he says, we do not walk in the laws, the ways of the idolaters. Rama is Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who we mentioned before in Krakow, and he says, and we do not try to appear like them. We're not supposed to try to look like them. And there we get Rabbi Karo's comment following, one should not wear garb which is unique to them. When there is clothing that is worn by non-Jews as an identifier, so Jews are not supposed to wear it. We aren't supposed to look like those who are around us. I think somebody quoted before, I think it was Dalia, we have a midrash that suggests that the Jews in Egypt dress differently from those who are around them. And in fact, that's a merit. The fact that we stand apart in that way is considered to be very positive. So Canon 68 from this Lateran Council is onto something in understanding that there is a preference for dressing differently, for not emulating. But I think that I would say that that separation exists beyond clothing. Even though we are taught that we are supposed to be supportive of society and create peaceful communities. So take a look in source number 18, where we are specifically taught in the Talmud, we support those needy people who are not Jewish along with needy Jews. We visit people who are ill, non-Jewish, along with Jews. We take care of burying the dead, non-Jews and Jews, in pursuit of peaceful paths for Darkei Shalom. We want to make sure that we build a community of peace, so we're going to take care of everybody. However, if you take a look at source number 19, and I'm rushing a little bit because it's 10:55, But if you take a look at source number 19, the story of Jacob's meeting with his brother Esau, who had wanted to kill him, and Jacob ran away. And 20 years later, Jacob comes back to the land of Israel, and he meets his brother. And his brother doesn't want to kill him. His brother says, let's travel together. Esau says to Jacob, let's travel together. And Jacob replies, as you see in source number 19, he says, well, you know, the children are very young, and my sheep and my cattle are nursing their young, and it would be bad for the sheep. No, you go ahead. I'll meet you eventually. And Esau says, oh, no, let me at least take some of the people who are with me and, you know, delegate to you. Let's join forces. And Jacob says, oh, why would you want to do that? You don't want to do that. And they end up going separate ways. Jacob will not go with Esau. In source number 20, the prophet Bilam, who was trying to curse the Jews, ends up blessing the Jews, calling them, they are a people who dwells alone and who will not be numbered among the nations. And that's looked at as a positive. Because it's already 10:57, I'm going to skip a little bit. But I did want to note source number 21, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, in an essay in 1967, at the time of Vatican II, when the church was looking to create dialogue with Jews. So Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote, we cooperate with the members of other faith communities in all fields of constructive human endeavor. But simultaneously with our integration into the general social framework, we engage in a movement of recoil and retrace our steps. In a word, we belong to the human society, and at the same time, we feel as strangers and outsiders. We got both. But the difference between what the church is doing and what we are doing is that they're doing it as a weapon of degradation. And that's really what it comes down to. It's degradation. It creates vulnerability. It's an attack. Whereas what we are looking to do is to say, we cooperate with others, but we are our own community. We have our own identity, not so much via tzitzit as through some of the other sources that we brought. And if you take a look at source number 22, this is a midrash which captures it, I think, better than I could say it. Talking about how in source number 20 we were called a people who dwells alone. So the midrash in 22 says, when we say alone, not like Bilam's alone, not an alone that is a curse, we have no support, we have no relationships, where he said there are people who dwells alone. And not like Jeremiah's alone, in the book of Echa, right, Lamentations, which begins, Echa Yashva Badad, how has she come to dwell alone? Not alone like that, but rather like Moses' alone, when Moses describes how God is going to guide the Jews alone. Vayishkon Yisrael Betach Badad, when the Jews are going to rest alone, not alone in the sense of being vulnerable, but alone in the sense of being a separate nation with a unique Jewish identity. That's really what we're going for. Made it into 10 by 10:59. I hope the end wasn't too fast. Questions and comments?
Great talk.
Okay, thank you.
As always.
Thank you very much. Dahlia. And then Rosalind, I see you also. Dahlia, you're muted.
Okay. Just to go over again, I never quite put Nazi into with Christianity. So I see in other countries like Poland, like Romania, like the more Christian type of society.
You muted yourself. Rosalind? Sorry, Dahlia, you're going to have to unmute, but Rosalind, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to ask you, many of these dress codes are about men. When did Jewish women, Orthodox Jewish women, start to cover their heads, their hair?
Good, so we're getting to that later in the series. That is a topic I'm planning on addressing.
It's a great lecture.
Oh, thank you. Thanks very much. Betty?
I learned, but I think I'm more depressed now than when we first talked about the anti-Semitism on Saturday Night Live.
I'm sorry.
This is like, just some.
I hear you. Sorry. Have some more chocolate. That's all I can tell you. Yes, Ethie.